And welcome to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Later in the hour, we are talking about the microchemicals, PFAS, and taking your questions at studio2@whyy.org. We'll talk about these forever chemical levels in the environment, how they get into our bloodstream, and efforts to decrease our exposure, Avi. Lots to talk about today.
Before we get there, we're going to talk about what happened late last night in Harrisburg. Legislators in Pennsylvania finally passed a spending plan. We're going to talk about the budget and why many lawmakers are unhappy. But before we get there, Cherry, let's round up some news.
All right. So, you know, New Jersey is expected to redraw its tourism map, Avi, to end a long-held debate. So many residents say New Jersey has two regions, North and South. But apparently now there will be a Central Jersey.
Officially.
This will be official. A bill passed the state legislature last week to prompt this redrawing of the state's tourism map with two no votes. And Governor Murphy is expected to sign it any day. Got to rewind back to his 2018 inaugural speech. That's when Governor Murphy called North, South and Central. He said North, Central and South Jersey, an extended family striving for success. By the way, Murphy lives in Middletown, which is about as Central Jersey can get. And I have to say this to you, Avi. I've lived in this region, and my first job was in New Brunswick, New Jersey, which happens to be located in Central Jersey. And I did not know that there was a Central Jersey. So I learned something new.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I'm concerned. I mean, where does it stop? I mean, is there a Northeast Jersey? Is there a Southwest Jersey? I'm just kidding. I have no opinion about this whatsoever. It's great. Central Jersey, you exist. Congratulations. This is officially going to include Mercer, Middlesex, Somerset, and Hunterdon counties. That is Central Jersey as far as the state of New Jersey is concerned.
Yeah, and if you didn't know, that's where you live. Guess what?
You live in Central Jersey.
You're a Central Jersey resident. There
you go.
You're
a Central Jerseyan. So I guess you said it ended the debate. I don't think this ends the debate. I don't live in New Jersey. I don't really understand why this is a debate, frankly. But I believe the debate rages on.
Yeah. And this is all about tourism dollars. That's what they say. So that people can come to Central Jersey and spend their money and know that it, too, is a destination and not just South or North Jersey. So kudos to the people who, you know, Central Jersey, who felt like they were neglected. You know what I mean?
Sure.
They don't get any love, you know.
I don't know how that could, I don't understand how this is supposed to contribute to tourism, but okay.
Yeah. And you can weigh in with us, tweet at WHYY with the Studio 2 hashtag and make your case. Is Central Jersey a thing?
Let's go to South Jersey now and let's just stop talking about Central Jersey. There are new developments in the attempt to build offshore wind turbines down near the Jersey shore. This project, we've been talking about it on and off for a while. It's called Ocean Wind 1. Mm-hmm. It's by a company called Ørsted, and they're trying to build nearly 100 wind turbines off the coast of South Jersey. And recently, they got a key federal approval from the U.S. Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. They still need some other federal approvals and two more minor state approvals, but the company says they're on track to begin construction on this controversial project this fall.
Yeah, and it's been controversial because some local community groups have opposed the project. They're blaming the deaths of at least 60 whales on the East Coast due to the prep work for the wind farms. The accusations are currently being reviewed by a federal accountability office. Also, fishermen could be disrupted a little bit, but, you know, Ørsted has promised that it will compensate these fishing businesses for lost revenues and will reimburse them for any lost or damaged gear. I will say that a lot of folks in New Jersey want this because it's promising good paying union jobs, and it could help New Jersey be at the forefront of a climate change initiative like wind energy.
Yeah, 500,000 homes, supposedly, that this project can power using wind energy. And first movers are always important. Whether this fails or succeeds is going to set the path for everyone who wants to come behind them. Obviously, there's wind in more than one part of the ocean, so this is not the only project I would imagine that is viable just from an energy production perspective. The question is, can they get through all the regulatory approvals and show the others who might want to come behind them that this is indeed possible? And we shall see.
We shall see. And another thing we shall see will be folks' take on a version of the national anthem that was sang on the 4th of July by the one and only Philadelphia native Jill Scott. She sang her own version of the national anthem at the Essence Festival in New Orleans. If you have never heard of the Essence Festival, it's a music festival hosted by put together by Essence Magazine with an emphasis on Black women. It's been in production since 1994. And I'll set that up and just let you hear Jill Scott's version.
Oh, say, can you see by the blood in the streets that this place doesn't smile on you?
And again, that is singer Jill Scott. She's known for helping to create that neo-soul sound here in Philadelphia. She changed Oh Say Can You See by the Dawn's Early Light, what so proudly we held at the twilight's last gleaming, to Oh Say Can You See by the blood in the streets that this place doesn't smile on you, colored child. She has other lyrics that she switches as well. And so far, Essence Magazine hailed this version. What do you think?
Well, I was most intrigued by the fact that she wrote this when she was 19 years old, supposedly. That was 32 years ago. I guess I'm telling you her age now. But so she wrote this when she was really young, living presumably in Philadelphia at the time. And it certainly reminds you of all other types of interpretations of the anthem. I can't recall another prominent case of someone changing the lyrics this way, but certainly like Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock playing the anthem on electric guitar, very distorted version, which had its own political implications. So it seems to be joining in that tradition. And like you said, it got a ton of attention, right?
Yeah, it went viral. And I'll also give you another lyric. She says, whose blood built this land with sweat and their hands, but will die in this place and your memory erased. So she talks about the history of slavery and all those things. I will say there was some pushback because, you know, the national anthem is sacrosanct in this country. So people could be some backlash to it. But so far, mostly praise for Jill Scott for her rendition of the national anthem.
So let's head on over to Harrisburg now for our newsmaker interview, where the main question of the day seems to be what? Katie Meyer is joining us. She's a government reporter and editor at Spotlight PA. Katie, welcome on into Studio 2.
Oh, it's so good to be here. Hello to both of you.
Hello
to you. Okay, so I said what, but I guess to flesh that question out, Katie, what exactly did the state legislature do last night? And do we have a state budget? I know it was supposed to be done by the end of the fiscal year. Is there a state budget now?
So yes, complicated question. In order to answer it, I'm going to back up a tiny bit because, you guys may have seen there have been negotiations happening for the last several weeks on a budget. The deadline was June 30th. They blew through that. And at issue was this dispute, really over a relatively small program, over a school voucher program, which would give student scholarships, funded via public money to attend private schools. It was controversial. So what ended up happening was the governor, Josh Shapiro, a Democrat, came out in support of vouchers, negotiated a deal with Senate Republicans that included a voucher program of $100 million. And then the deal went over to Senate Democrats and they said, we will not pass this. We do not want vouchers. What happened yesterday was that Shapiro sort of, you know, changed his approach and said, okay, Democrats in the House, because they control the chamber, but only by one seat, Democrats in the House, I will, if you pass this bill, this budget bill that was negotiated with Shapiro and the Senate, I will veto out the voucher part. So Shapiro said, he would sign the budget into law, except for that part, which he would do is called a line item veto.
And that means that it doesn't go back to the Senate now for them to say, no, we won't approve it. They've already approved it.
They've already approved it. And so the Senate took this as the word that they used was a betrayal. They had negotiated with Shapiro in good faith, and he turned around and stabbed him in the back. Democrats said, well, that's the way the cookie crumbles. But now we're in a sort of strange limbo space at this moment, because I'm in Harrisburg now. The House is back. They're passing stuff. They still have to pass code bills, which we can get into if you want. But one of the things that the Senate is still able to do is there's this little procedural requirement that they have to come back in, and the presiding officer of the Senate, the lieutenant governor, has to sign the bill. No problem. The lieutenant governor, of course, will sign this bill. But the Senate needs to reconvene in order for him to do that. Because they are now mad at Josh Shapiro, they are delaying reconvening.
So Shapiro does a procedural thing, and the Senate Republicans say, we can one-up you. We'll do our own procedural thing back. And there's, I guess, still no budget.
Well, yeah, exactly. And to be clear, too, so Shapiro, he hasn't done his procedural thing yet. He has only promised to do so. But yeah, the Senate, I don't think they can do this forever. That's what I've heard, you know, just on background from a lot of people in the Capitol. The minute they reconvene, the lieutenant governor can go ahead and sign this and send it to the governor. So unless the Senate just simply never comes back ever again, it'll happen eventually. But the bigger thing that still needs to be negotiated, is code bills. And so what the House has passed and what the Senate had already passed to Shapiro was a spending plan. But what still needs to be passed is these complicated sets of bill language that say how the money should be distributed. So it's often referred to as the language that implements the budget. And that could be a fight now that everyone kind of has their feelings hurt.
And I just want to zoom out a bit because we know that there's this battle. To the extent we do get this version of the bill passed, can we dig in a bit? What are some of the big line items as far as the winners and the losers of this budget as it currently stands, minus that little line veto?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good question. This is a budget that, again, was negotiated primarily with Josh Shapiro and the Senate Republicans. And going into this, Democrats have all said education is our priority. There was recently a court case earlier this year that said that Pennsylvania's education funding system for public schools is unconstitutionally inequitable and needs to be fixed. So going into this, Democrats were like, we need more money for education. We have to start fixing this. And Republicans were sort of on board, but their spends tended to be a lot lower. They were really concerned about a structural deficit. They wanted to save up a lot of the surplus that the state now has. And so there were those different spending priorities, and there have been some other battles over smaller things. But what this program, what this budget does is it does increase funding for education, not as much as Shapiro initially wanted, certainly not as much as House Democrats wanted, but it does increase funding. It puts in new state money for the Whole Home Repair Program, which was a big thing for Philadelphia Senator Nikhil Saval. It was his big program that he did, which gives subsidies for people to fix their houses. I could go on. I mean, there are points of contention over several items in there. There wasn't as much money as some people wanted for mental health funding for counties, but there was a new universal free lunch program or free breakfast program that went in, which is a big deal. There would also be funding for indigent defense, public defense of people who can't afford a lawyer, which is a big deal. Pennsylvania was the only state that didn't fund that.
And we have less than 30 seconds, Katie, just so you know.
So anyway, I'll cut it off there. But there's a lot in this budget.
It's a big budget.
It's just not quite done.
Well, I want to say thank you so much. That's Katie Meyer, government reporter at Spotlight PA, one of our former colleagues here at WHYY. Thank you so much for being here on Studio 2.
Oh, pleasure to be here.
And a very quick disclaimer, we want to mention that WHYY does receive some money from the state of Pennsylvania, so we are in a very small way a part of this budget. So,
yes.
Let's transition now back to New Jersey. That's where we started.
A lot of time in Jersey.
We went over to Pennsylvania for just a second. We're going to talk to New Jersey AG Matt Plotkin about his state's lawsuit against a company that produces PFAS. And then we're going to have a big conversation about PFAS chemicals coming up in the next segment on Studio 2. Stick with us.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
And welcome back to Studio 2. Hello, everybody. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. You've probably heard about PFAS by now, the so-called forever chemicals that don't break down easily in the environment. They're used in all kinds of consumer products, things like nonstick cookware, fast food takeout containers and wrappers, makeup, dental floss, and stain-resistant furniture. That list goes on and on.
These chemicals end up in our water, soil, and even air. And there's evidence that PFAS are harmful to human health. Here's another long list for you. They've been linked to cancers, infertility, endocrine and immune problems, high blood pressure, and cholesterol.
But we're making some progress regulating them and holding companies accountable for PFAS pollution. Last week, Attorney General Matt Plackin announced a historic $393 million settlement with the Belgian company Solvay at its West Deptford, New Jersey facility for PFAS water contamination in Gloucester and Camden counties. And he joins us now to talk about the settlement and holding companies accountable. Attorney General Matt Plackin, welcome to Studio 2.
Matt, are you with us?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Yep, yes. We can hear you now.
Welcome to Studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful. And so I just want you to lay out this settlement and what it means for New Jersey.
Well, this is, as you said, a historic settlement. And the first and foremost things it means is that Solvay is going to clean up the mess that it made in our state. And you went over some of the dangers of PFAS and how harmful they are to the people who live in and around the West Deptford site, but really to people all across the country. And so the settlement's going to do a number of things that make it historic. First, Solvay's going to clean up the site, as I said, and they're going to put $214 million up to make sure that the funds are there to clean up the site. That number will be evaluated every year. So if the costs go up, their commitment goes up. Their second, they're going to give another $100 million to pay for future investigation and cleanup by our state for the harms caused by their pollution. They are going to then give us $75 million in what's called natural resource damages. That's a significant and historic number, because what that money will do is it effectively compensates the residents of the state for the harms caused to the pristine land that they previously had. So it allows us to invest in projects that will bring the land back to the way it was before any pollution was caused there. And then lastly, they're going to pay the state for the investment that we've already made into the site cleanup. So altogether, as you said, it's $393 million, the single largest settlement for a single site natural resource claim in the history of our state. And it shows you that how serious we're taking PFAS contamination. I think every other company out there that has potential exposure or is currently litigating with us should see this and understand that we are going to fight tooth and nail to get the recovery for the residents that we deserve so we can keep them safe.
Does this settlement include any admission of guilt or any admission that the company knew they were polluting this site?
So the full settlement will be available on the DEP website, and I'll let, you know, shortly, and it's also going to be posted in the register. I'll let people read the settlement and see it. But what it clearly includes is a recognition that they have to clean up the damage that they caused. Again, $214 million just for the site alone, plus another $175 million or so to support cleanup in and around the site. Things like cleaning up well water, public and private wells that may be contaminated, making sure that we're giving people safe drinking water that they deserve. And so there is clearly an admission there, but I'll let the settlement speak for itself as to what Solvay's saying.
Yeah, Solvay had already done some work, and they called the settlement a collaborative approach between them and the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. I got to ask, and they also say that they're not the only source of PFAS in South Jersey. And I understand that New Jersey also has other lawsuits pending against a number of other companies. What are those companies and where do those lawsuits stand as well?
Yeah, so I commend Solve for coming forward and settling this litigation. But, you know, we had to sue them back in 2020 to get them to do what they're doing now. And the law, without the lawsuit, I think we had seen that they wouldn't have done the scale and the scope of the recovery that we need. And that's what we're responsible for doing in the Department of Law and Public Safety. And as the chief law enforcement officer, my job is to keep our residents safe. And that includes keeping people safe from environmental harms. We sued Solvay in 2020. We've sued a number of companies for PFAS contamination, those including 3M, DuPont, Related Defenders, Chemours, and Corteva, and a number of other cases that we have ongoing, including the co-defender in this case, in the Solvay case. And we will continue to litigate them. But I think the message that we're sending here is clear. PFAS is dangerous. It's harmful. And if you've polluted our state with it, you violated our laws. And we will continue to fight these cases tooth and nail to get the recovery for the people of New Jersey. And so I hope that the lesson that other companies see is that it is in their interest to come forward and try to resolve these, because we will litigate them to the fullest extent. And we will seek significant penalties because we know how harmful this substance is and we know how difficult it is to remediate it. And that's why getting a $75 million natural resource damages settlement here on top of the restitution that we're getting for the state is significant and historic, because that is the single largest natural resource damages settlement we've ever had in the state. And I think other companies should see we're going to continue to push for that.
Attorney General Plotkin, if those companies that you named don't receive the message from this settlement, you said you are willing to go to the fullest extent of the law. So that means what? A jury trial? What is the next step if there is no settlement with these other companies?
Yeah, if we can't resolve the claims, we will litigate them through trial if we have to. And we obviously wouldn't have filed a complaint if we didn't think that the evidence was clear. And I think what Solvay's shown here is that the evidence was quite clear against them. And so while they may not be the only source of PFAS in South Jersey, they are a significant source. They wouldn't be paying almost $400 million to clean it up if they weren't. And I commend them for that. But they were a significant contributor here, as are the other companies that we have filed litigations against. And, you know, ultimately, there will be a day in court. I hope that they would come forward and want to resolve it. I think it's better for the companies. It's also better for the residents that we can get to restore these sites quicker and provide relief more efficiently. But if they won't, we're prepared to litigate them. These are not cases that we're just going to forget about.
Now, that was Attorney General Matt Plotkin of New Jersey. Thank you so much for joining us on Studio 2.
Thank you both for having me. I really appreciate it.
Now we want to pivot to talk more broadly about PFAS, their health effects, and the regulations around them. And for that conversation, we bring in Scott Faber with the consumer advocacy organization Environmental Working Group. Scott, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Great to be with you.
And if you have any questions about PFAS, you can email us, studio2@whyy.org. All right, let's dig into this, Scott. I want to backtrack first. Why did companies like 3M and DuPont and Chemours develop these chemicals? I mean, they must be very good at something. So what are they good at?
Yeah, well, these are amazing chemicals. They help make our products stain resistant, fire resistant. They're used in many, many different ways in the economy. And they would be truly amazing if they weren't so strongly linked with cancer and harm to our reproductive systems and harm to our immune systems. And unfortunately, the manufacturers and users of these chemicals have known in some cases since the 1950s that these chemicals were toxic, that they were poisoning their workers and their neighbors and ultimately the rest of us. They just never bothered to tell anyone.
Yeah. And when you think about these chemicals, first of all, I understand there's thousands of chemicals that fall within what we call PFAS. What are those chemicals and what do they do to your body specifically that makes them so toxic?
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, they're known as forever chemicals because they never break down. They're man-made chemicals. That also means they stay in our bodies for a really long time. And among the things we know, because of the enormous library of peer-reviewed evidence that's been produced by scientists, is that these chemicals are linked to some cancers, including prostate, kidney, and testicular cancers. They're linked to some reproductive harms, including decreased fertility. They're linked to developmental effects or delays in children, including low birth weight, accelerated puberty, and behavioral changes. And they're linked to harms to our immune system, in particular our body's ability to fight infections, and changes to our immune systems that make our vaccines less effective. So these aren't just ordinary chemicals. They are among the most toxic chemicals we're exposed to, and we're exposed to them in myriad ways, not just in our drinking water.
What does linked mean, or strongly linked mean, in this context? Because I've read that 98 to 99% of us have this stuff in our body. And, you know, obviously some people don't seem to suffer ill effects from it, or we at least can't prove that. So when we say linked or strongly linked, like what are we actually talking about?
Yeah, it's a great question. And some of these chemicals are more toxic than others. And certain people are more likely to be exposed to PFAS than others. Think about the workers who make or use PFAS to make things. Think about the folks who live near factories or airports, especially Department of Defense installations, or military firefighters and civilian fighters who handle PFAS and firefighting foams, or literally wear PFAS in their firefighting turnout gear. The good news, I suppose, to call it good news, is a recent National Academy of Sciences report went through all of the peer-reviewed evidence and looked at the various peer-reviewed studies that show whether or not there's strong evidence or sufficient evidence to ultimately support these connections, that support the likelihood that a lifetime exposure to many of these PFAS will cause the cancers that I've talked about, especially testicular and kidney cancer, that might cause the reproductive harms we've talked about, like reduced fertility.
Yeah, and if you just tuned in, we are speaking with Scott Faber, Senior Vice President of Government Affairs at the Environmental Working Group. If you have a question or comment about PFAS and you want answers, you can email us at studio2@whyy.org. Scott, I read that this was a preventable problem that we're seeing now with PFAS and contamination in the environment. When did we find out that PFAS were a problem, and why did it take so long for us to start doing something about it?
Yeah, this is so frustrating for folks who are listening and wondering, why have I been drinking PFAS in my tap water all my life? Why am I bringing PFAS into my home and my food, my cosmetics, my cleaning products, my carpets, my clothing, my upholstered furniture? And the answer to your question is that the companies that manufactured PFAS, 3M and DuPont, knew as early as the 1950s and 1960s that these chemicals were toxic to animals and ultimately toxic to their workers. Many of the companies that used PFAS to make other things like firefighting foam knew that PFAS was toxic in the 1970s and 1980s. And everyone who used or made PFAS certainly knew that PFAS was toxic by 2000, when one of the makers of PFAS withdrew from the market, and the government finally learned from the makers of PFAS just how toxic these chemicals are. So we've all been on notice, that is regulators, manufacturers, just not the general public, that these chemicals have been toxic for decades. What's so frustrating, and I'm sure it's very frustrating to your listeners, is that companies can still use PFAS, especially in products that we bring into our homes and businesses, and that companies can still discharge PFAS into the air, into the water, with no restrictions whatsoever. Even though we now know that these chemicals are linked to cancer, linked to reproductive harm, there are still no limits on PFAS polluters who are dumping their PFAS waste into our rivers or pumping their PFAS waste into our air.
All right, so what do we do now moving forward? And we can approach this question from several different angles, Scott. But let's talk about the production of products with PFAS. How would you, if you were, you know, king for a day, would you say, hey, these are the products? Yeah, congratulations. would you say, hey, these are the products that should not have PFAS in them at all, but There are some products that need PFAS and are essential products we don't know how to make any other way. Yeah. Like, is there a class of products we still need to have some PFAS in just out of necessity? Or is the idea, hey, zero, none, no products?
Well, the good news is we don't need a monarchy to solve this problem. And indeed, our democracy in many states is already solving this problem. Many states, including New Jersey, many states have taken steps to ban non-essential uses of PFAS, like PFAS from food packaging, PFAS from cosmetics, PFAS from cleaning products, PFAS from rugs, PFAS from other textiles. So there is a lot of action in our state legislators that is already beginning to protect us from non-essential uses of PFAS. In particular, the state of Maine has set up a whole process that their legislature has set up a whole process to methodically look at all uses of PFAS and make a determination. Is this an essential use of PFAS? Is this a non-essential use of PFAS? In order to begin to end the uses of PFAS that, frankly, we should have never allowed in the first place.
But what are the essential uses? And that implies that there are essential uses. Like, what are they?
Well, and part of what we're figuring out, what Maine's figuring out, what our EPA is figuring out, what regulators in Europe are figuring out is precisely what are those essential uses. They're looking at how do we make semiconductors? How do we make medical devices? How do we make other electrical components? How do we make other things that we wouldn't necessarily bring into our homes and be exposed to, but still produce a lot of PFAS pollution because PFAS is used in the manufacturing process? We're looking at all of those products and asking the question, do we need to use PFAS to make them? And in many cases, the answer is no.
And to follow up with that, I mean, does that mean that there are alternative chemicals that can be used? And are those other chemicals, would they be harmful as well?
Yeah. Well, there are very few chemicals that are worse for us than a toxic forever chemical that's building up in our blood and linked to cancer. But it's the right question to ask. Unfortunately, the way our EPA is set up, the laws that set up our EPA, we're not moving very quickly to answer that really important question, which is, do we need to use this chemical in the first place? Are the alternatives that we might use, are they safer? And so we do need to accelerate the process of asking those questions and asking them in a way that doesn't make this problem of exposure to toxic chemicals even worse.
All right. We want to, of course, pass laws, hold companies accountable. But end of the day, people have to live with this risk every day. It's in our environment already. And so we have an email here from Marisol who says, I use a reverse osmosis water filter. Does that filter PFAS? And I think maybe expand on that a little bit, Scott. First of all, what is reverse osmosis water filter? But also, are there things that individuals can use to reduce their risk?
Yeah, that's a great question. And before I answer that question, one bit of good news is that in addition to banning PFAS in food packaging and cosmetics and cleaners and textiles and rugs and all sorts of other products, 10 states have also set their own tap water drinking standards. So 10 states, including Pennsylvania and New Jersey, have set standards that water utilities have to meet before they send you your tap water. So while there's a lot of bad news when it comes to PFAS, especially the irresponsible behavior by many of the polluters and makers of products with PFAS, there's also some good news that especially in our state legislators, where states are really taking the lead. There's also even some good news from Washington, where the Biden administration has proposed a national drinking water standard that all states have to meet. So not just the 10 that already have drinking standards, but all states would have to meet, so that no matter where you live, the tap water coming into your home will have to meet standards for, in this case, 6 particular PFAS. That's great news. And as sure many of your listeners saw, the USGS recently found almost half of all the all the drinking water they tested had PFAS, which means many, many millions of Americans have been drinking a toxic forever chemical without knowing it. A reverse osmosis water filter system is among the most effective systems at reducing PFAS in tap water. I have one in my home. They're not hard to install. You can install them right under the sink. They're really effective at reducing PFAS. But we also have some new test results coming of various water filters later this month. So yeah, Tune into EWG's website for more on that.
Got to ask you a quick follow-up just to the water. I mean, there are also products. How do we know, like, how can we tell if something we're using has PFAS in it? I mean, is it labeled? Is it how can we just be sure that we're eliminating those if we can?
It's a great question. And unfortunately, with the exception of cosmetics, where it would be on the label, so look for things like PTFE or anything with the word fluoro in the ingredient, we really can't know. It's impossible to shop around this problem. None of us have labs in our basements. We're not toxicologists. We're really counting on our federal and state governments to protect us. And so unfortunately, there is no way to know. And that's why it is so important that states like New Jersey and Pennsylvania have begun to ban, you know, what I call, the stupid uses of PFAS.
Jane asks via email if municipalities are required to test and inform about PFAS in their water systems. So you mentioned state and federal regulations, but of course, then someone has to there has to be like a way to check whether the water actually has the PFAS in it or not. So do the municipalities do testing on a rolling basis? Do they never do it? I mean, who actually checks to make sure people are following these rules?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So there's two answers. One is that once the Biden administration finalizes a drinking water standard for the six PFAS, including the most notorious PFAS, PFOA and PFOS, all drinking water utilities will have to test for the presence of PFAS in finished tap water, in your drinking water, and they will have to share those results with their state regulators. And we ultimately collect all those results and put them on our website in a tap water database. So pretty soon, probably not this year, maybe next year, water utilities will be subject to all of the standards that are being, all water utilities across the country will be subject to standards being set by the Biden EPA. And that's great news. Utilities will have to test to see whether they're complying with that standard. In the short run, at the end of July, this month, EPA will begin to release even more testing data that will, in particular, looking for 29 particular PFAS, and they will begin to be releasing that data in tranches for different water utilities around the country, different systems around the country. Those test results will only be from public water systems or water utilities serving more than 3,300 people.
So no wells.
But most of us live in, no wells. So wells are completely on their own. But if you're on a public water system, if you're on a community water system, if you pay a water bill every month and your water utility serves more than 3,300 people, you will know sometime soon how much PFAS is in your water.
And we only have a couple more minutes, but I got to ask you, is this something we should be extremely worried about, a little worried, or what? And then how much PFAS is too much, you know, for us? Because, you know, you hear about this and people could become extremely concerned. Let us just sort of, you know, temper this and tell folks where we stand.
Everyone measures risk differently, but these are very toxic chemicals that are very toxic in very small amounts. When the EPA tried to set limits for PFAS, they asked, what's the safe amount of PFOA and PFAS that we can be exposed to in our tap water? And the safe amount, they concluded, for PFOA and PFAS was 0.02 parts per trillion and 0.004 parts per trillion for PFOA and PFOS, respectively. Those are very, very, very small numbers. So these are chemicals that are toxic at very low levels. But there are steps you can take to reduce your exposure.
And we have to end the conversation there, but it's been a fascinating one and an enlightening one. That is Scott Faber with the consumer advocacy organization Environmental Working Group. Scott, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Thank you.
And coming up, Studio 2 Trivia Thursday.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
I'm Cherry Gregg, and this is Studio 2.
Hello, everybody. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And today is another Trivia Thursday for us. Avi, I heard we're going international today.
I almost can't believe it. Yes, apparently our contestant, Eric, is a Westchester native, but is calling us from Madrid, Spain, where he listens to Studio 2. Eric, welcome to the show. Buenos dias, or maybe buenas noches.
Buenas tardes, Avi. Buenas hey, it's a pleasure to be here.
I got corrected right off the bat.
Yeah, whatever. It's
what time is it there? Yeah.
It's 6:49 p.m. Awesome. So it's a little bit later. It's just after the siesta, and we're just getting ready for a long afternoon and a long evening.
Well, you got
to
tell us.
It stays light here until about 11 p.m., so it's always fun to enjoy.
Well, are you ready to play, Eric?
Sure.
Sure. Okay. So this is how it works.
Absolutely, I
want to
say.
All right, there you go. There you go.
All right. So, Eric, this is how it works. I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to give you four choices. If you get it right, we are going to pay the international shipping and send you some Studio 2 swag. Is that cool?
Fantastic. All absolutely. Right. I will be the only person in Madrid wearing this.
All right.
We got the brand has to go international.
It has to go.
Okay. So listen carefully. Mark Ruffalo, the actor, stars in at least two movies connected to Delaware's DuPont Company. In the movie Dark Waters, he plays a lawyer suing DuPont over PFAS contamination. In the movie Foxcatcher, Ruffalo plays an athlete living at an estate owned by a member of the DuPont family. What sport does Ruffalo's character play in that film? Is it A, wrestling, B, water polo, C, baseball, or D, fox hunting?
It's an excellent question. And I am a big fox hunting, you know, follower. Mm. Though it was wrestling. It's based on a true story.
My God, he's good. Eric, great. Well done. Well, it is indeed wrestling, and it is based on a true story. I was like, should I tell people the true story? Because if I tell you it, then it completely ruins the movie. But it was a good film. It came out, I think, 2019. Did you see the movie, Eric?
No, but I'm familiar with the true story.
Yeah, but we're not gonna spoil it. It's a crazy tale.
It is a crazy tale.
Regardless, Eric, you have won Studio 2 Trivia. I congratulate you. It's Buenos Tardes, right?
Buenos Tardes. So and now I can actually wear your swag and stream WHYY all the time here in my kitchen in Madrid. I'm thrilled.
Fantastico.
Fantastico. Thank you so much. That
was it. And gracias. We'll keep on working on that Spanish.
Okay, yeah.
Your accent will be better than mine at the end of this.
Fantastic. My tutor, Eric, you did a great job today on Studio 2 Trivia.
Winning from across the pond.
Winning from across the pond.
A pleasure to be part of this. Thank you. You guys have a great show.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. We really appreciate that, Eric. And we appreciate everyone for listening. And now we're going to pivot as we always do.
I got to mention, if you want to be our next trivia contestant, right. Call us now. You know, leave a message, 215-351-0525. And, we just got out of a long weekend, but we're about to go back in. So Tanya Pendleton's got a great list of things to do.
Still tired from vacation? It can be strenuous laying by the pool and lifting a beer from the cooler to your mouth. I get it. But that's no excuse to sit this weekend out, because if you do, you'll miss out on some great music. The hardest working band in Philly, Snack Time, is kicking off the Oval summer season on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
During July and August, Eakins Oval transforms into The Oval, hosting performances from dance to theater to music every Friday night through August. There are also yoga classes, a marketplace, a beer garden, and on Saturdays, special activities just for kids. We'll have the details on our website, whyy.org/things to do. Best of all, it's free. While we're talking kids, there's another fun place you can take them to this summer. Pixar movies like Toy Story, Ratatouille, and Soul are the theme of a new miniature golf attraction on Penn's Landing. It's called Pixar Putt, and it will be at the Great Plaza through October 1st. Each of its 18 holes is themed to a different Pixar movie. While daytimes are just for kids, selected evenings are adults only. Reserve your tickets now because this has high sellout potential. The musical version of Moulin Rouge comes to the Academy of Music on its national tour after winning 10 Tony Awards during its Broadway run. The stage version is based on the Baz Luhrmann film, which came out in 2001. You may remember the soundtrack featured Lady Marmalade, sung by Christina Aguilera, Maya, and Pink, with Missy on the intro and a rap by Lil' Kim. Moulin Rouge, the musical, started this week in a limited engagement through July 23rd. Dead is good, at least in the case of some musical acts coming to town. First, the Dead Milkmen. Philly's own punk rockers have resurrected their career and will head to Laurel Hill Cemetery for a show Friday night at 7:30. Seems like a fit.
Oh, brother, please look at me. What do you see? Let's travel around the world, just you and me, punk rock girls.
And in Ardmore, Dead, White, and Blue is a three-day celebration of all things Grateful Dead. It's anchored by the longtime Dead tribute band, Splintered Sunlight. Shows go from Thursday through Saturday at Ardmore Music Hall. Splintered Sunlight brings the good vibes, but there's no better vibe creator than Erykah Badu. She's coming to the Mann Center on Sunday on the Unfollow Me Tour. Yasin Bey is her opening act. He's the hip-hop artist formerly known as Mos Def. Expect to elevate your vibration. The show starts at 7:30. We're celebrating the 50th anniversary of hip-hop, and so, we imagine, is Ice Cube.
Straight out of Compton, crazy name Ice Cube. From the gang called With Attitude.
Lauren,
what's up?
Tell him where you're from.
Straight out of Compton.
The former NWA member turned solo artist recorded some classic albums, but is now an actor, writer, producer, and director. His son, O'Shea Jackson, followed in his father's footsteps, playing him in Straight Outta Compton. He recently starred in the Apple TV Plus series Swagger. Ice Cube will be at Ovation Hall in Atlantic City on Friday night at 9. We're heading out in our lowrider, hitting those switches. Well, at least in our minds. But we are cruising out of this week's Things to Do. We'll be back Thursday with more choices to upgrade your weekends. We invite you to head to our website, whyy.org/things to do, where you can find out what's cooking with black chefs this weekend and why Franklin Square will be lit for some time to come. Whatever you choose to do, have a great weekend, everyone.
Yeah, have a great weekend, everybody. I second that.
I do, too.
By the way, she mentioned Punk Rock Girl by the Dead Milkmen, which is one of my favorite songs by a Philly band. And the music video for the song was filmed at Eastern State Penitentiary and is a really great music video. So I just wanted to say that. I don't know why I felt compelled to say that.
Yeah,
it's a great music video.
It is.
It's a great song. Punk Rock Girl, one of my favorites.
And this is music season in Philly. Lots of great artists coming here. So I'm just, I just love this.
Are you going to any concerts coming up?
Beyoncé next week.
Wow, we'll need a full report back on that.
I would love Erykah Badu, but can't do both. Too much.
too much. Sorry, Erica. Our producers today, not Beyonce, but people even better than that. Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. WHYY Audio General Manager is Joan Isabella. Al Banks is our engineer with assistance from Mary Cummings. Jordan, shout out MCJ. For more of our show, head to WHYY.org/studio2 or download us wherever you get your podcasts from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. My name is Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And my name is Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a wonderful rest of the week.